This is FinTech Takes, the podcast keeping you in the loop on all the latest FinTech trends, news, and ideas. I'm Alex Johnson, creator of the FinTech Takes newsletter, your host and self-confessed FinTech nerd. Let's go. Before we get started today, I wanted to tell you about another FinTech podcast that I'm a huge fan of, FinTech One-on-One, hosted by Peter Renton. If you don't know Peter, he's a true OG in the FinTech space. He created FinTech Nexus, formerly Lendit, one of the premier events and media companies in our space, and he's been a consistently great interviewer of executives and experts in FinTech and lending on his podcast since 2013. Let me say that again. 2013. Peter's been doing this for a long time. He's just as curious as I am about all things fintech, but he's much smarter than me and has a delightful Australian accent. So be sure to check out the FinTech One-on-One podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, and welcome back to the FinTech Takes podcast. My name is Alex Johnson, and I have an incredibly special episode for you today, an episode that took a while to pull together because my guests are very busy and important and difficult to get on the phone at the same time, but we got them. They are here and we're going to have a ton of fun. I want to introduce them first and then I will explain the concept for today's episode. So going first is Gabby Kazo. Gabby is a partner at Harlem Capital, where she invests in, well, fintech, I think, and e-commerce and platforms. Gabby, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Alex. And sorry again for the scheduling mishaps, but super excited to be here today.
No. You are absolutely worth waiting for. I really appreciate you joining us. We are also joined by another investor in the fintech space, Emily Mann. Emily is a partner at Primary, where, again, she focuses on fintech and enterprise software and has been in the space for a while. Emily is one of my favorite writers and thinkers in the space. Emily, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Longtime listener, and so I'm very excited to be here.
Yes. All right. Longtime listener, first time caller. This is going to be so much fun. What we're going to do is workshop some theses for FinTech. One of the things I find really interesting about writing the newsletter and doing the podcast is that part of my job, I think, is very similar in a lot of ways to what investors in the space do in terms of observing what's happening, formulating theses for where things might be going. The difference, of course, is I don't have to put my money or someone else's money where my mouth is. I just get to kind of spout off and then leave it there. That's why one of the podcasts I do on a recurring basis is called Not FinTech Investment Advice with Simon Taylor, because I do not myself offer FinTech investment advice. And while we're not going to be offering investment advice on this podcast either, we are going to be taking turns workshopping some very early theses that we have for the space and what's happening in it. So the plan is for Gabby, Emily, and I to take turns introducing a thesis, just something we're kind of thinking about, noodling on, maybe trying to research or understand a little bit better. And hopefully by talking those out, we'll all come away with a slightly better understanding of how we're thinking about how the space will evolve. Are you guys ready?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's jump in.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to go first because I want to get my sort of dumb theories out of the way so that Gabby and Emily can shine here. But the first one I have is sort of an observation, I guess, which is that open banking is obviously coming, or one could argue here. But by the end of this year, we're going to have hopefully a finalized rule for 1033. We're going to know what the rules of the road are for open banking in the US. And one of the things that seems very clear to me, based on progress that's been made in the market to date, what the CFPB has explicitly said, what other consumer advocates, folks in Congress, lots of folks in the ecosystem are talking about, is cash flow underwriting is going to be a thing, right? And not shocking or surprising, I'm not breaking any news here. Obviously, cash flow underwriting is not a brand new concept, but it does feel like an idea whose time has come. And depending on who you talk to, cash flow underwriting can be a replacement for the FICO score and traditional credit data in some contexts or some products. Other folks you talk to will tell you it's much more of a supplement or a complement to the FICO score and to credit data. I believe somewhere sort of in the middle of those two things. But here's my thesis, which is if we accept the fact that open banking is here to stay and that cash flow underwriting is going to be a mainstay use case, my theory is that we are not anywhere close to being prepared for all of the infrastructure that's going to have to change around cash flow underwriting to make it as ubiquitous and sort of useful to lenders as the FICO score is today. And my conviction for this comes out of the fact that I've worked in lending and credit scoring for years and years and years. And it's really easy when you talk about cash flow underwriting to go, okay, well, new data, which will replace the data at the bureaus or complement it, new scores that are being built by pretty much anyone who's in cash flow underwriting is in the process of like releasing cash flow driven scores right now. So you can kind of see very clear parallels like credit bureau data, cash flow score, FICO score. Like you can very map those things together, but there's a whole, that's like the tip of the iceberg. And everything under the iceberg is to me where all of the stuff is going to have to change that we haven't made a lot of progress on today. So this includes everything from obviously like not just scores, but attributes that you can use to build your own scores, model and attribute development and deployment. There's a software product called the Attribute Toolbox that Experian built years ago that's actually pretty much deployed everywhere that lenders are using credit bureau data because it's a really slick way to deploy attributes and to speed up model development. There's no open banking equivalent to that. All of the credit decisioning and loan origination software that's in the market today, if you think about the experience that applicants go through when they're filling out an application, hardly any of them are built around getting permission from the consumer. So all of the applications are going to need to get rebuilt. All of the workflows behind the scenes for credit decisioning, loan origination, dealing with stipulation, manual review, all of those are going to need to get redesigned. And then even on the back end, things like loan servicing, things like helping secondary market investors who invest in loans as an asset class evaluate those loans and what you can do beyond the FICO score to look at like open banking data and evaluate the quality of those assets, collections, recovery, like the entire life cycle of how you not only make a lending decision, but then manage loans as an asset ongoing. All of those things are going to now, to a degree, revolve around open banking data and cash flow underwriting, and hardly any of that infrastructure has been built. And so to me, when I think about open banking, and obviously not a new category for investment or a sort of shocking thesis, I do think that there's a hidden iceberg to cash flow underwriting that we haven't been talking a lot about. Let me go ahead and let you react to that.
Well, cash flow underwriting is a concept that's near and dear to my heart. I mean, especially since I invested in Ramp at my last firm, right? And so if you really think about the unlock that Ramp and Brex and a lot of these old corporate card, next gen corporate card companies had, it really was around like, hey, you're a Series A company that has raised $8 million. Maybe you have like $500K in ARR or $1 million, and a traditional bank would not give you anything because you don't have 3 years of operating data, but like you should be able to get a credit line that is commensurate to the amount of money that is in your bank account. And so I totally agree that like, look, both of these companies have had to rebuild a lot of the systems in-house, starting from underwriting all the way through servicing, right? The one area, and like this is an open kind of question I'm curious for both of your thoughts on, is the FICO score or any sort of credit score, as we think about it, comes with two components, right? There's the ability to repay and there's the willingness to repay. I'm trying to think through like what, as you were talking about this, I'm like, how do you capture that second piece, like the willingness to repay? Because I might have the right amount of money in my bank account to pay back this $500 buy now, pay later loan that I took out that you saw through whatever insert open banking infrastructure today. But what's to say that I won't like transfer that out the day before the payment's due, right? Like, how are we going to solve for that second part of the equation?
That's a great question, Gabby, go.
I was just going to say, I wonder if that then comes as we think about what new forms of data we might pull into, what like a net new type of FICO score could look like, or FICO plus, or I guess in this new world, something entirely different that then lets us bring together all of the new pieces of information we'll get from an open banking perspective, and then with some new infrastructure, be able to use that to make some of these new decisions. Because you're right, someone has the proof of that willingness to pay, but doesn't, then what might those repercussions end up being? Or like what other mechanisms might financial institutions have to either claw back or then not penalize sort of like businesses or consumers across the ecosystem, but find a way to make that willingness to pay more like that, really create that driver for that obligation to pay?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a really good point, Gabby, because, I mean, one thing people don't like to hear when you talk about lending is there needs to be a carrot and a stick, right? And like one of the things that works well with the credit bureaus and the FICO score is it's something that as a consumer, you have a incentive to protect and to make sure that it stays good. And like, you know, the choices you make about how you manage your financial obligations or even what financial obligations you sign up for to a degree are influenced by, am I going to damage my credit by doing this, right? And so I think that's a really good point. And I look at places like Buy Now, Pay Later as an example of this, where Buy Now, Pay Later has mostly sat outside of the credit bureaus and the FICO score. They haven't reported that data. And this is specifically those pay in four loans that happen over a 6-week period. Those ones are really interesting because I do think they do send at the moment kind of a signal to consumers that says, you know, it's actually cool if you don't pay us, right? Like we're never going to loan you that much money and we want you to buy this thing because we're getting, you know, paid by the merchant. And, you know, for the most part, there's not going to be any late fees. We're not going to charge any interest. And so like, we're not going to report this to the bureaus. Like there's really no penalty for doing this. And I think that when we get more deeply into the world of cash flow underwriting, we are going to have more of a mechanism. And I'm not sure exactly what that is going to be that does sort of have a bit of a downside to misuse, right? Because like with looking at your bank account data, you can sort of extrapolate looking at bank account data. Oh, there's a payment to Klarna, right? So you can get some insight into history of paying financial obligations. But as someone who worked at the credit bureaus, or I used to work at FICO, as any of those folks would tell you, there is a limit to the data that you can see through open banking relative to what you get out of the credit bureaus. And so I do kind of come down on the idea that open banking and cash flow underwriting is not going to fully replace the FICO score or the credit bureaus. But I do think it is going to supplement it for folks who are sort of on their way up and have never had credit before. It'll be a nice on-ramp into the credit system. Maybe we won't have credit builder products in the future, which would be nice for me personally. And I think that it also will, my pain is real, guys. I can't.
I'm laughing because I've read every single one of your pieces on my
It's going to take one more for me to just completely flip out and lose my mind. Although I will say, to the credit of everyone in the ecosystem, when people are now building new credit builder products, I'm actually getting a lot of calls early on like, hey, can we bounce our idea off you or like check on this? I'm like, yes, please. I'll always take those calls because like build credit builder products in a better way. But I do think cash flow underwriting can help with that part. And I do think it can supplement the insight that you get into consumers. And it goes back to something you said, Emily, not just, you know, ability to pay in the moment, but the other thing that it demonstrates, I think, depending on how much data you can get, and we'll see what the CFPB mandates in terms of the length of history that you need to be able to share, but it can also give you a really interesting window into stability, which is something that you can infer from the FICO score and the credit bureaus, but it's not exactly what those things measure. But it's really a question of, you know, Gabby, how long have you had a good paying job? How stable is that job? How stable is your income? How stable is just your general financial situation? And that stability can be a really powerful signal as well. So I do think it is going to play a much bigger role in underwriting. And again, I don't think all the infrastructure we have today is quite ready for it. Any other reactions to it before I let you guys go with your next one?
I think the thing that kind of came to mind a bit, particularly with the consumer example about like their own personal financial stability, is with this new system or the new system that emerges, I think then there's also an opportunity to make sure that we are not further penalizing people who might also be on that rise up, who might not have already had a great credit score or credit score, you know, a strong one to begin with, where some of that stability piece that might come with some of this cash flow underwriting, you know, might also then continue to hamper their ability to move up that ladder, if you will. And so how else might we think about what needs to occur for those, you know, that subset of the population, which is, you know, increasingly larger, but just to make sure people aren't further sort of pushed out of the financial ecosystem as we create and build new tools.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that just to put a final point on that, the thing that everybody wants at the end of the day is to make the best possible risk decision, right? And I think the thing that's kind of cool about open banking and adding this data is done in a compliant way. And we've seen Plaid become a consumer reporting agency. Like, you know, everyone's kind of being brought into the compliance infrastructure that exists in credit and lending already. Done in a compliant way, I think what this data does is it just increases the odds overall that you're going to get a price for whatever credit you're applying for that's most reflective of your actual credit risk. And so the ability for sort of this mispricing to be maybe not eliminated, but more reduced really does appeal to me as kind of the opportunity that we're driving to. And Emily, to the point you made before, this applies to consumers and companies, right? There's a whole category of businesses out there that have had a really hard time getting access to credit because they don't have a Dun & Bradstreet credit file, but they have good cash flow and they should be able to get a loan that allows them to jump up to that next level and build their business. It's just getting a different view into their credit worthiness. So, all right, we'll leave that one there. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Emily, I'm going to have you go next and give us one of your early half-baked theses.
Great. I actually have one that's very similar and on a very much the same theme. Thinking about, in particular, as many of you probably have been, fraud and identity, and how this is going to be a much worse problem, given everything that we're seeing in terms of the leaps and bounds of what generative AI can do in terms of faking a selfie or a driver's license or now even video, right? And what that's going to mean for a lot of the solutions that exist today and how that becomes obsolete. Now, I know that this in itself is like not particularly controversial, but I'm trying to think through, and I would love both of your mind's inputs on this, in as what, how can you re-architect fraud solutions and identity solutions from the ground up in a way that isn't just going to be like a whack-a-mole problem of like, let's add this new signal or this new data source, and then the fraudsters find another way around it, and like, then let's keep going and make it even better. And so there's kind of a couple different ways that I've thought about it. Like, one, you could build a centralized identity system, right? Now, that's probably not going to be out of the reach of a private company. We're probably going to have to see the governments take a more active role in that. But if you look at what Aadhaar has done in India and how 1.2 billion people are now enrolled in this system that is somewhat, you know, it's partially like a ID number based, partially biometrics based. And there's controversies in and around it too. But in terms of financial inclusion and access to credit and products, it's been a huge unlock. Or this is where the real half-bakedness comes in. What if you created something that was more like a dynamic identity score, right? Mm. Or you put someone's identity at the core of it and you created some sort of a risk-based underwriting that is updated on a continuous basis. And so where I'm coming from with this is, let's just take two very different examples, right? Like my fiance, he's a software engineer. He's taken a ton of cryptography classes. He cares so much about making sure he has the right password managers and really secure X, Y, and Z in terms of his own personal identity versus my mom, who uses the same password for probably like literally everything and writes them down in like her notes app, right? And so how can you incentivize my mom to be more like my fiance, or at least capture that level of like willingness or security at an individual level and use that as part of your identity sort of verification process?
I love that.
I like it.
It's so funny. I was thinking the same, both from like a financial services lens, but then also e-commerce fraud, which tends to be the world that we're thinking about things through quite a bit. I'd say maybe the third bucket to your like central identity or dynamic score, maybe a mix of the two, is more of like that, what does that portable identity or KYB then look like across other like for businesses? So that like as either you identify a bad actor or can sort of verify someone isn't a bad actor, that stays with you through the life of the business. And then can be used, you know, to continually verify the that identity over time. But I think it's been a huge space that we're thinking about right now.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I've been writing a lot about digital identity in the newsletter recently, and I'm actually going to go to a policy forum in DC in a couple weeks with a bunch of people who are going to be sort of bringing their different perspectives on identity together. And, you know, it's the one of the things that someone pointed out when I was talking to him about this is the idea that just at like a bare minimum, much in the same way that like from a credit underwriting perspective, we treat everyone very differently depending on like, you know, you get into the path and depending on the data that you have, your history with that specific provider, they send you down one of a million different paths, right? Depending on like all the data and like the work that they ask you to do is very different. It's strange that in identity, we don't have that, right? Like in identity, it's like everyone must do this. And then you do all of this work And then as soon as you come back either to that provider or to a different provider, you have to start all over and do all of that work again. And it's strange that, A, Gabby, to your point, you don't get to like take any of that work with you or reuse it or be able to sort of carry that trust through the ecosystem or even just with that one provider. And then, you know, Emily, to your point, the fact that it's not dynamic and associated to the individual is also kind of strange, right? And I know there is some like transactional risk scoring. I was actually just looking at the Alloy fraud benchmark report that they do. And
it's a great...
It's a really good... Yeah, the data in it is awesome.
Yeah, it's a really good piece.
Yeah, because they survey all of the... They survey a bunch of people who are in like fraud risk roles at fintech companies and banks. And one of the things that they found was that there's actually been a great deal more reliance on transactional fraud detection rather than like account or application fraud risk detection. And so it's almost one of those things where because we've let so many like bad actors through the front door, we sort of are like, okay, we can't even trust our onboarding anymore. So now we need to just very carefully watch every single transaction and score that transaction and score the risk associated with it and the device and the location. But once that transaction is over, if we approve it, then it's just like we threw that fish back in the sea and then we'll see what happens next. And it's like a very weird, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Memento where the person's always forgetting what happened. And so they have to like give tattoos to like remember. Like it's fraud risk is almost dealt with in that way where it's like, what happened? I don't know. Let's check our, you know, arm to see if there's a tattoo telling me if this person's a good person or a bad person. So I do think there is just this kind of, Emily, to your original point, this break point that we're headed to where like this model is just not going to work pretty soon. So we need an alternative.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I actually think that the transaction by transaction based approach that we have to take today is part of the problem, right? Because I mean, it's like, it's the way that we think about identity or we score identity is so binary. It's yes, no, like good actor, bad actor, new transaction comes in, score that, yes, no, good actor, bad actor. And I think that that helps for a lot of the major types of fraud, like let's say account takeover or synthetic fraud. But one of the things that I was recently reading is actually one of Soups the Sardines posts in around how first party fraud is increasingly becoming a problem. And, you know, the I'm not Gen Z, but the Gen Zs call them the hacks. You know, you see them all over TikTok these days. And so I'm like, how do you incorporate all of that together in something that maybe... One conversation that I had that I thought was really interesting is, can you dynamically unlock parts of a product or credit or different types of levels of access or ease of use based on your operating history with a certain sort of provider, whether that's financial services or e-commerce or whoever? And I think that in order to achieve that, though, you do need a little bit more of like a re-architecting of all your systems to have the individual as the core rather than to be looking at transactions on a yes-no basis.
Fair. I'm also struck by your other point about like whether, you know, where the federal government does step in, right? Like where does that centralized sort of solution start to emerge? And at what point, you know, in this, well, I guess, will it happen fast enough to start to, before we get to that breaking point that you mentioned too, which, you know, I don't necessarily see to be the case, but I do think at some point there needs to be that centralized option or sort of like system to help solve that too.
Well, it is wild, kind of going to your point about the system they have in India. It is kind of funny talking about this and being like, they've basically solved this in other parts of the world. Like, they just solved it. They're just like, yeah, you know, the government came out with this mobile identity system. You can get a physical credential. You can get a digital credential. It's all managed out of this centralized database. It's, you know, the credentials are secured to your phone with your biometrics, blah, blah, blah. Like, and it's just done. It's solved. And like, all of us in the US are looking at that going, how are they doing this? This is amazing. And I do think there is, you know, Gabby, to your point, there is a cultural element to all of this, right? And in the US, we have a very cultural element. I live in Montana, and this is like a perfect expression of how we think about things in Montana, which is like, under no circumstances should the government be allowed to have a database about me and my identity. And I don't think that's a very good way to do it. It's not the optimal solution, but I do think it is one of those things where you sort of have to accept it and then kind of work around whatever that constraint is. And we are seeing states introduce more kind of like electronic or digital identity systems. California has a pilot in place. I think Louisiana actually has a system that's up and running that started with hunting and fishing licenses, which people take very seriously, and then it expanded into more sort of generalized identity cases. And so there are small pilots that are happening on the public sector side that I think maybe over time can be stitched together or brought together in a way that would be useful. But yeah, I feel like, you know, we're going to have a ways to go. One last thought on this one is, and it touched on something, Emily, that you mentioned before about sort of big kind of categories of fraud, like account takeover, synthetic identity fraud. I do actually have some hope that we're going to get a little smarter about how we do this, thanks to the rise of like social engineering and scams, right? So a huge part of the sort of fraud challenge today, and I think the FTC just came out and said that last year, 2023, Americans lost something like $10 billion to fraud. And in 2013, it was like $1.6 billion. So the problem is getting like massively worse. And a big contributor to it is social engineering, tricking someone into authorizing fraud, authorized push payment fraud, that kind of stuff. You see it with Zelle in the US. You see it with a lot of different kind of authorized payment schemes in the UK and elsewhere. But the thing that I think is really interesting about it is it has pushed banks and fintech companies, Emily, kind of in the direction you were saying of like, let's have a much more nuanced and sort of granular user experience where we're not going to say yes and we're not going to say no. But what we're going to do, because we're a little suspicious of this particular transaction, is we're going to introduce all these little points of friction into the experience. And like the very sort of simplistic version of this is the bank going like, you know, here are all the boxes you have to check because this could be fraud and this could be whatever. But there's a much more sort of gamified and sort of subtle way to do that where you can just sort of change the checkout flow or you can change the transaction flow dynamically because you're a little bit suspecting it might be fraud and you just want to make the hill a little steeper to climb up before someone gets to the other side of it. And there's so much room there to kind of re-architect that experience to, I think, sort of give people more time to sort of manage fraud or to think before they click the checkout button or whatever it is. And I think a large part of how we deal with this is just going to be a more sort of subtle, dynamic, in some ways gamified experience to help consumers and merchants and other people in the ecosystem just have a little more friction or time to deal with some of these challenges. That seems like a part of it as well.
I totally agree. Although I will say that you do need a big change in infrastructure on the back end to be able to do that.
You do, hence why this is a good possible investment thesis. All right.
There you go.
Emily, that was a great one. Gabby, we are so excited to hear your first one. Please share with us.
Yeah, I was going to hit a bit on the fraud one, but since we've touched on that quite a bit, I guess an area that we've been looking at quite a bit more, and it's, I guess it really hones in a bit more in some of the work that we're just doing in vertical software, but it's really automation in the accounting and tax space. I think there's a couple of different trends coming to play. One, you know, what the power of what LLMs are able to do is they, as you think about all of the unstructured data that exists in both of these categories, I think there's also some ancillary, you know, opportunities in the insurance space and legal, et cetera. But if we just think about accounting and tax, you know, huge inefficiencies in how people are working today, big long tail of companies and potential folks to serve. But I think the biggest piece here is just like that bottleneck of talent that we're seeing where there's so much work and there's a proliferation of that that's going to continue that you're just having increasing bandwidth issues with small teams. And so really thinking about the new software platforms that leveraging AI tools can help tax and accounting professionals to optimize their workflows with the opportunity to become that accounting operating system or the operating system for their firms and then sort of to tap into any sort of like payments, reconciliation, and other opportunities that might exist.
I like that one. I think that one's great. You mentioned the focus on just like bandwidth and just like people and kind of like the funnel there. It's interesting. One of the things I've developed is kind of a sort of reverse thesis for trying to think about like where are the opportunities for LLMs to be applied. One of them is, where is it like the best time ever to be like a gig worker or a part-time worker or freelancer, right? So it's like, the more that you look at like a particular space and you're like, wow, you have a full-time job, you know, being an accountant, you should quit your job and you should work through these six different platforms that exist to be a front end for accounting because you can charge double your rate to each one of these and you can make twice as much money as an accountant. And really what that tells you is there's way more front end infrastructure that's been built to make you know, it easy for small businesses to sign up for an accounting service or whatever. Like that front end part of the funnel has been solved, but on the back end, they're all scrambling for humans to plug into their model in the same way that, you know, Uber and Lyft quickly had a problem recruiting drivers and getting drivers to come in. And I think that that Uber-Lyft analogy is actually a really good one, because who were some of the first companies to express an interest in like self-driving cars, right? Like if our problem now is drivers and sort of the back end talent part of this, well, what can we use with AI and machine learning to sort of fill in the gap there? And accounting, I think you put your finger on it, that seems like a huge area where everything I see is like, there's not enough people going into this space. It's just a little too complicated for sort of simple machine learning or automation or rules to do. There's a huge like customer service back and forth sort of element to it. And everything I'm describing are things that LLMs can really help with, right?
For sure. And I think the last piece that maybe got missed is just the vast amount of data that can be extracted from every document and everything that, you know, a company or even an individual is sending into their accounting firm. And I think the way that we think about LLMs and sort of vertical software is A, not to replace anyone, but then how do you supercharge the people who are already working in those categories or in those spaces, make their work better. And then ultimately that helps them just make more money and drive revenue for their businesses. So in our stack, that tends to be where we want to focus.
That makes sense. Well, and I think the other thing on that is just that the nature of the work can change too, right? I've heard people describe one of the value props of LLMs is no one should ever have to like parse a document ever again in the history of mankind, right? Like OCR is great, but it only works if you have a really defined template where the data is always the same and you can build a model around that exact template to extract data from. But if you throw any like curveballs at it at all, it freaks out and you have to have a person do it. But it's like the lowest value human work ever. And to your point, those people can be better spent doing other tasks sort of further up the value chain. So that makes a ton of sense. Emily, what's your reaction to this one?
Yeah, I think of these markets, and I think it's totally fascinating, but as this like fundamental supply and demand mismatch.
Yeah.
Right? Because on one hand, you've got this kind of shrinking labor pool of supply. But at the same time, like if you actually look at what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, like if you actually ask them how much of their time are they spending doing people's taxes, it's probably like, I don't know, 30, 40%, if I had to guess, or accounting. Like the rest of it is admin work, or it's getting new customers, or maintaining existing relationships, or answering customer queries. And I think that 60% of the job is the opportunity for whether it's a tech company with an aggregated brand that's just really good at going to market and acquiring customers to just be like, hey, you know, you are a star accountant. Like, don't, I mean, this is a little bit what Pilot has sort of done.
Totally.
In many ways, right? If they're a trusted brand, you go to them, they tell their accountants like, hey, don't worry about like growing your business or thinking about like getting top of funnel in, like just do your job and we'll take care of that side of the house for you. And then you layer on the abilities of LLMs to help them scale themselves in these day-to-day tasks. And I think that you can have something really interesting here.
Yeah, that's a really good point around the surround, but then also just to your point, that 60%, like what else can be done? So love that one.
Yeah, no, I very much agree. I mean, it feels like I sometimes think about these things in the context of my kids who are really young right now, right? But it's like, when they come to me, this won't happen because they'll be teenagers, but say they did come to me when they were 16 and were like, Dad, I would love some career advice. Like, what would I tell them? And it is really interesting when you think about how this trend plays itself out over time, because we will have these like super scaling agents that can be sort of wrapped around what you do and like what you want to do and where you can be most productive. And I always think about it, I almost think about it in terms of like, and it's, I think someone was talking about this on Twitter. Forgive me, I can never cite people's ideas on Twitter because it just goes by me too fast. But someone was talking about the idea of, I spend way too much time on Twitter, but the idea that like there will be a unicorn-sized company that has like 10 people or like one person or whatever, right? Like how would the scaling laws for building a business change thanks to LLMs? And I do, particularly around a lot of these tasks that we're talking about, like accounting or legal or these other areas, you know, the profit pools are going to shift around a lot, I feel like, because you know, so much of these tasks are necessary for building a business, but they're not inherent to the value that the business provides. And so I do think there is going to be a massive redistribution of profit pools and value thanks to LLMs, just basically unlocking the ability to do these things faster, more efficient with less people.
I call it services as a software is my working title.
That's a great one.
Should
trademark that one now before the podcast launches.
I was going to say,
yeah.
All of us are really like jealous going, ooh, that's a good one.
Quickly tweet it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm on Twitter right now, so it's already too late, Emily. Sorry. No, that's a good one. Okay. We have time for like a couple of more. Do either of you have like maybe one more, like one that's a little more outside the box or one in an area we haven't touched on yet? Emily, I see you nodding your head. Do you have one? Okay.
Yeah, I've got one. All right. One of the things that I've been noodling on, and this is even more out there, is in and around the growth of quote unquote shadow banking.
Ooh.
Right. Mm. So it sounds ominous. It's really not. But if you look, you know, following the global financial crisis, like the TLDR is for banks, it got really hard to lend. Right. There were so many new restrictions that were introduced. There were so many new regulations. And so what happened is you saw this massive transfer of risk to quote unquote shadow banks. Right. And so what are these like non-bank credit institutions, like what many of us know, you know, pensions, PE funds, asset managers. But if you look at the data, the amount that U.S. financial institutions have loaned to shadow banks has now surpassed $1 trillion. And it grew 12% last year. And just to put this into context, that's 6% of all loans, right? Which is right below credit cards at 7% and right above auto loans at 5%. And I'm trying to think through, like, what are the downstream effects that this means for our banking, credit, and even financial broadly ecosystem? Because as the money supply continues to tighten, the banks are going to continue to pull back further on lending, leading to this even bigger credit gap. And then private creditors are going to increasingly turn to the Apollos, Blackstones of the world to get their credit. And it's not inherently bad, but I think what can happen is, and we saw this in the global financial crisis, is you can obfuscate systematic risks that are happening across different portfolios because of the sort of very low level of insight that one can have into what actually is in these underlying portfolios and what the sort of incentive structures are, right? And so the types of opportunities that I'm thinking about here, I mean, part of it is I think that you're going to need new ways to underwrite. And so going back to what we were talking about before with cash flow-based underwriting, I think for banks, there's going to be need to be better sort of treasury and portfolio management solutions. And then software tools that are going to re-architect kind of underwriting debt, portfolio management, real-time monitoring, and kind of give that real-time insight into what exactly is going on and where are there correlations in between underlying risk. But yeah, I want to throw that out there and see if anyone has a reaction.
That's a good one. That's a very good one. Private credit. I don't think I had that on my bingo card for something that was going to come up on the podcast. That's a great one, though. I've written about private credit a little bit and it's sort of its emergence over the last couple of years in particular. And yeah, I totally agree with your thesis, right? I mean, the basic takeaway is that post-financial crisis, the capital rules that we put in place for banks basically pushed them out of certain parts of the market, right? Because the capital was just too expensive for them to focus on lending to particular areas. And so that's where, and I think Jamie Dimon had a great quote about, you know, every time you toughen up capital rules on banks, Blackstone and those guys sort of, you can see them dancing in the street, right? And there's basically this sort of like trade where it's like, okay, we can't be in this business anymore, but someone has to step into it. And, you know, private credit is kind of amazing because it's not even like a zero interest rate phenomenon, right? It's really not, it's continued to explode even as rates have gone up. These asset allocators have stayed in this space and have grown their exposure to it. So I think you're absolutely right about the potential risks and challenges that come with it. The one I sort of hone in on within this broad world is, if you think about the great financial crisis, one of the sort of challenging parts of it was there was just this assumption that the assets at the very bottom were really good, right? Like who defaults on their mortgage? And so you could do all these complex sort of financial engineering things on top of it, and you never had to really look at the actual like loan level data on where the money was actually going and if the mortgages were good. And then, of course, everything blew up because people were taking out mortgages that they couldn't afford. And I kind of wonder if in the new version of all of this, it's not that we won't have shadow banking. We will, right? Like, I don't see capital rules getting easier for banks. Like, this market dynamic is going to continue to exist. But I wonder if the infrastructure that needs to get built is just better monitoring and evaluation of the assets that sit at the very bottom of this, right? So, you know, to your point, Emily, like, I've wondered for a long time, what's the arbitrage opportunity for being able to do a better job at essentially evaluating the assets that are for sale on the secondary market, right? Like, why are we just looking at FICO score cutoffs or hiring a firm to like go in and do a cursory evaluation of the loan level data in these like deal rooms? Like, why can't we apply better analytics to it? Why can't we use open banking and cash flow underwriting? Why can't we connect to ERP systems to look at like the institution's actual like books and everything that's happening? All of that stuff is getting digitized. So it feels like all of that asset level data should be able to flow through and at least help people better manage the risks that are getting pushed outside of the shadow banking system. So that would be how I would sort of react to that broad thesis. Gabby, what's your take on it?
Yeah,
I think that's fair. I think as you were talking, Emily, about sort of the three-pronged approach and focusing on solutions for banks, I'm almost wondering then on the flip side, is then there an opportunity for solutions for the Blackstones of the world to better understand and manage their own book in a better, more attractive way? But yeah, I totally agree, Alex. That's a really interesting way to think about it.
Well, and to your point, Gabby, I mean, there's lots of like, I mean, you want to find like antiquated ways of managing risk. Like, go look at some of these private credit deals, more so for like investing in like companies, like when private equity would invest in, you know, a company and do like a corporate commercial loan that's private. That's sort of more classic definition of private credit. Those things are governed by credit agreements that are like 800 pages of like dense covenants. And, you know, someone has to go through and redline each one of those things. And you have to be able to monitor a sort of level of compliance with all the covenants. You're supposed to be able to kind of identify breaches. When Citi had that problem where they accidentally fat fingered that payment to Revlon and actually sent way too much money, that actually ended up becoming a new clause in every credit agreement from then on, sort of governing like how that needs to work. And so to your point, I mean, I think there is a massive amount of inefficiency in the way that sort of call it historical private credit has managed it. And again, it's because in the old days of private credit, it was like, all right, we're going to make one $15 million loan to this private company. Okay, well, like, you know, that's a very like bespoke product where you have to do a lot of bespoke work. But as private credit starts to infiltrate all these other places, when it gets into asset-based financing, private credit is the thing that's behind a lot of the loans that fintech lenders are making now, right? It's all private credit that's providing the funding for that. Those assets can't be evaluated in the same way that a $15 million, you know, loan to a business can be, right? And so the mechanisms by which you do that and the infrastructure you have to build to enable that, it's completely different than the way it's traditionally been managed. So yeah, no, Emily, I think you're definitely onto something with this one.
Yeah, I'm with you. And like, look, this is not something that's going to go away. And like, fun fact, my first internship ever back when I lived in China as a college student was I worked for a shadow bank.
Oh, really?
Sponsored by the government or a multinational corporation. And the way that like those debt packages were structured was just like absolutely insane to me, right? I think that there's so much low-hanging fruit to be captured here. Even just something like, think about what happened with Archegos and Bill Huang, and like he promised his collateral a couple of times to a couple different banks and they just weren't speaking to each other. And so I think that there, you know, as a trend, this is going to continue to grow. I think that there's a lot of institutionalization or structure that needs to exist to help facilitate the management of private credit in a way that helps prevent the next financial crisis, hopefully.
No, yeah, I totally agree.
If we don't get that level of visibility, who's to say, you know, it becomes that house of cards all over again? Now it's gotten so large that it does start to impact every fintech that's, you know, relying on that entire stack.
No, it's absolutely true. I saw an article the other day that sort of scared the bejesus out of me, which was when it was talking about private equity firms either buying or investing in life insurance companies. And they were basically seeing life insurance as a source of sort of steady annuity payments that they could then use to fund a lot of this private credit and other investment classes that we're talking about. And so the more all these different worlds get sort of intertwined.
Aye, aye, aye.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like I can see Michael Sue at the OCC just flipping out, you know, going, oh my God, you know, like bad things are happening. And I almost wonder, just to add one last thought before I let you guys go, I do wonder if there might be sort of resurgence in like fintech infrastructure for regulators or for the government. Because I think that's the other part to all of this that's really hard is, you know, you listen to like speeches given by federal regulators. A lot of the things that they'll talk about are, we need to get a better handle on this. We need to figure out the size of this problem. Like, you sort of get the sense reading between the lines that they have like a data issue. Like, they don't have visibility yeah. into this. And I think that that's not good for them, obviously. But long term, it's not really good for any of us to let these things grow beyond kind of what they're supposed to. And so I do wonder if, and selling to the government is its own whole, you know, ball of wax. But I do wonder if there is an opportunity to build better infrastructure for regulatory agencies that kind of becomes like a voluntary model where it's like, hey, we have this system. And if you want to plug your systems into it so we can get visibility into what you're doing, you're going to get safe harbor or you're going to get an easier treatment from us versus this other path where you don't have to. We're not going to make it mandatory, but your life is going to sort of suck if you don't. And like, these are your two options, and kind of create more of a tech-driven approach to regulatory oversight. I wonder if that might be a side effect of all of this as well.
That's interesting. Like, who could become the Vantor or Drata for financial regulators?
Yes.
Sit between where, you know, you're actually a service to those companies. But then to your point, there's got to be a mechanism where you're getting some sort of benefit for even opening up your data and allowing yeah. regulators to get that inside look that they don't have today.
Yeah, exactly. I think that might be an opportunity. Okay, well, we're going to leave it there because I've already taken too much of your valuable time. This was so much fun to bat about some of our theories, half-baked ideas for the space. We'll have to do this again. But in the meantime, Gabby, Emily, thank you so much for joining me on FinTech Takes.
Thanks, Alex.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FinTech Takes. Stay up to date with emerging companies and the latest FinTech trends by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love FinTech Takes, please tell a friend.